Lake Effect brings you conversations about what's happening in Milwaukee and the people, places, and organizations that shape the community. This is Lake Effect Spotlight from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Milwaukee politician Vel Phillips died in 2018 at the age of 94. 6 years after her death, recognition of her monumental impact on Milwaukee and Wisconsin continues to grow. In 2024, it can be hard to appreciate the dedication and tenacity it took for Phillips to succeed after she started her political career in 1956 at the age of 32. But here's a reminder of all the firsts she accomplished. Vel Phillips was the first Black person and first woman to serve on the Milwaukee Common Council, the first Black elected statewide office holder in Wisconsin, and the first Black person elected to the Democratic Party's National Committee. From pioneering open housing legislation to serving as Wisconsin's Secretary of State, Phillips influenced countless crucial moments of our history. Recently, she's been recognized with a state statue at the Capitol and a plaza in Milwaukee. Writer Barbara Miner dove into Phillips' history and impact for an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to share more about it. Barbara Miner, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to be at WUWM.
Glad to have you. So we're talking about a very important woman today, Vel Phillips. And obviously a lot of people, especially locally, are familiar with Vel's accomplishments in her political career. But can you share more about her early years and her background?
Very complicated. And Vel is a complicated person. I mean, her very early background, she was born in Milwaukee, raised here in Milwaukee. But her parents were part of what was then sort of the established African-American community. Her father was a small businessman, restaurant, garage owner. So Vel grew up in relative, and I say that very loosely, relative comfort. And in fact, she talks about in her very early years when she went door-to-door with the League of Women Voters, I was just horrified at some of the conditions. And she said it broke her heart. And of those early years, her mother was clearly her strongest influence. And one of the things that is so associated with Vel is something her mother always said, which was, dream big. And Vel took that and other lessons from her mother, but took that to heart.
Vel has a ton of accomplishments. You know, we can't list and talk about all of them in our conversation today, but her political career started, you know, officially, shall we say, when she was 32 years old. She became the first woman and the first Black person on the Milwaukee Common Council. So can you share more context about the atmosphere and culture she was working in 1956?
Yes, the 1950s on some levels could as well be the 18th century in terms of how different it is from today. And I grew up in the 50s, you know, younger, but it's hard, I think, sometimes to appreciate what that culture was like for women and for Black people, but particularly women. I mean, for instance, there was not the approval of oral contraceptives until the 1960s, I think. Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique was not until the 1960s. And interestingly, it wasn't until 1974, we're talking 22 years after Vel was first elected, that women could have their own bank account or credit card. And so the 50s were a complicated decade, coming off of World War II, economic prosperity in many ways. But the life for a lot of women and people of color was very different. And after the war, women were expected to go home and make babies.
And, you know, you touched upon some of the atmosphere for women and then for Black people. And Vel obviously has a lot of compounded discrimination that she had experienced long before, you know, intersectionality had been a common word, right?
Exactly.
Can you share a little more about that? Because you had a conversation with her about what stood out to her the most about that.
Well, interestingly, I did a feature on Vel in 2005. Hard to believe that's what, almost 20 years ago. And I had the good fortune to really, I drove her around, we had interviews, we spent some time together. And I would go to events where she would be, like community brainstorming, where she would be moderating. And we'd have lunch and, you know, conversations. And at one point, I asked her, because she was known as the first woman, the first African American, I said, well, what was the hardest breakthrough? And initially, she just kind of, you know, thought about it and just said, you know, it was difficult, so to speak. And then a week or two later at the community brainstorming, she comes back to me. She says, you know, I've been thinking about that. And I really want to clarify And then she talked about Shirley Chisholm, who is a African-American woman legislator from New York, who also ran for president in the 60s. And she was friends with Vel. I mean, there weren't that many women African-American politicians, and so they all knew each other. And Vel said, you know, Shirley and I talked about this, and you're black. Of course you're black, and people know you're black, and they don't forget that. But you're also a woman. But usually once I was in a position, they kind of forgot that I was a black woman. She said, but they never, ever, ever forgot I was a woman.
So powerful, right? Like, and sad that that's the takeaway.
Yes. Although, interestingly, I mean, misogyny was ever present from the moment she stepped foot into the Common Council chambers. A lot of stories there. But it was really the issue of her being an African-American politician. That was the issue that really led to sort of concerns about her personal safety and the safety of her children. So while one was ever-present and aggravating, it did not rise to the level of physically threatening her, and that wasn't true around the open housing marches.
Right. Let's talk about the marches. Obviously, it's one of her key legacies is the open housing legislation. And I feel like most people know the marches and have a certain snapshot in their head, especially if they weren't alive during that time. Like we see the same kind of handful of photographs, right? But Vel was trying to act on this long before the marching tactic became enacted, right?
Oh, she was the first person to introduce the open housing legislation. And it was in 1962. We're talking, you know, 5 years before the open housing marches. In 1962, she first introduced open housing legislation, which would prohibit discrimination against African Americans in terms of renting and buying homes, which is very common at the time, open discrimination. And I believe it was like 15-1. She was the only person who voted in favor of it. And there were times, there were years, where it wasn't even discussed. She would bring up the resolution, no discussion, there'd be a vote. She would be the only person in support of the legislation.
And then eventually down the road in 67, she throws herself behind the tactic championed by Father James Grappi here and the local NAACP Youth Council, which was the public demonstrations. And I feel like this is lost in some of the snapshots, how extensive it was, how dramatic.
Well, in the mid-60s is when just everything exploded. And 1967 nationally was sort of this national unrest. There were, you know, uprisings in Newark, Detroit. They called the troops into Detroit, Lyndon B. Johnson. And Father Grappia, shortly before that, had started the demonstrations for open housing. Grappia and the Youth Council were sort of an in the streets. Vel was here working with the politicians on the legislation. And Grappi, they came to Vel and said, listen, we want to take this up as an issue. They'd been doing other issues around school desegregation, the Eagles Club and their discriminatory practices. And they said, Vel, we want to take this up. And Vel said, go right ahead. She wasn't always out there in the demonstrations because she was acutely aware of the different roles at times. But it was in 67 when things just went kind of crazy. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, but that was when, in line with all the different uprisings in Newark, Detroit, Milwaukee had its own. And what started it and how and why, there might be some differences of opinion. But what is known is that Mayor Meyer immediately, in sort of classic Milwaukee German fashion, shut down the entire city. Mail service was suspended. People were not allowed to leave their homes. It was just a complete and total shutdown. And the demonstrations had started before that. Things shut down. Some other things happened. But the bottom line is that after that shutdown was lifted, the demonstrations began again. And this is when Grappi and the commandos decided to go across the viaduct into the south side. And that night that they decided to do that, they were met on the south side. It was just as ugly as anything Milwaukee has ever seen. Bricks, racial epithets, things being thrown at the demonstrators, you know, go back to Africa, you know, calling, you know, Grappi a traitor, you know, to his race. Just ugly, ugly, ugly. But the demonstrators were determined. So for 200 consecutive nights, because I think back to George Floyd in 2020, But I'm thinking here, and that was the summer.
Right.
Here we have 200 nights in the middle of a Milwaukee winter, and they kept marching. And then again, yeah. once the national events intervened, mm-hmm. because that spring in April, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And again, just uprisings and protests all around the city. And at that point, and I think to this day, it remains the largest civil rights demonstration in Milwaukee history. Well, needless to say, about 2 weeks afterwards, the federal open housing legislation passed, and finally, Milwaukee woke up to reality. Some new alder people had been elected, and finally, the open housing legislation passed.
As we know, Vel, we obviously identify her with Milwaukee, with Wisconsin, but her impact on the national stage is also really good, too. And you go into her roles in the DNC both in 1958 and the 1960 conventions. Can you explain kind of how Vel set herself apart on the national scale here?
Well, it's fascinating. And again, a lot of it had to do with open housing. That's always been both locally and nationally her political marker, her main issue. But in 58, she was elected to the Democratic National Committee, first African-American woman. And then 2 years later, at the convention when Kennedy was nominated. So not surprisingly, there was lots of discussion and floor fights over the platform. And there was a push for a strong civil rights platform as part of the Democratic Party platform. And you had your Southern Dems, the sort of segregationists, who said, oh, no, we can't adopt this civil rights platform. You're going to lose the South. This is government-enforced social equality. And they were adamantly opposed. And Val was on the committee, and one of the lessons here is don't ever get into a political fight with Val. She was so smart, and she always had a good response. So she says to the senator, well, how can you expect the world to, you know, respect us if we don't even enforce equality here at home? But then more importantly, she said something that I think actually remains one of Val's enduring markers of her beliefs. And she said, listen, it's more important to do the right thing. Luckily, the civil rights platform carried the day, and Kennedy won the election because the Southern segregationists, they said, oh, no, you're going to lose the election if you adopt this. But they didn't.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Barbara Miner about her Milwaukee Magazine article on Vel Phillips. So, Barbara, you mentioned that Vel always thought it's more important to do the right thing. And I think it's kind of a through line for Vel in that throughout her whole career and all the challenges she faced, like there's the resilience, there's the tenacity, there's the quiet leadership by example. And she was many things, obviously, including proud, but she kept her personal life quite private, right?
Yes. Understandably, as a politician and as a woman. But one of the things that I think it's really important to get into about Val, in terms of her do the right thing, you know, to her dying day, she supported marriage equality. She supported a woman's right to choose. She supported LGBTQ. She supported, you know, school desegregation. She strongly supported public schools and opposed the voucher program. You know, you name an issue. She was a Bernie Sanders big supporter. You name an issue, and she came down on what, in hindsight, almost everyone recognizes was the right thing.
And she constantly fought for the right thing and for others, even if in her own personal life there was tragedy, right?
Yeah, Val was quiet about her personal life. I mean, first of all, she had this storybook romance and marriage to Dale. In fact, if you talk to Val's son, Michael, he calls his dad sometimes an original Mr. Mom.
Oh, sure.
Because while Val was out there, you know, going to the Common Council, demonstrating, doing this, doing that, Dale actually took care of a lot of the home front while he helped develop a respected law firm, largest black law firm in the state. He was part of the NAACP. He helped one of the big banks, the black banks in town. He, in his own right, was a very, very well-respected person. But Val was the one who was the politician, and he knew that, and he supported her in it. So Val didn't talk about it much, but people who knew when Dale died, somewhat unexpectedly of a heart attack, She lost it. And she, you know, Gwen Moore, who has known Val since high school, we'll talk about this. And she'll say, you know, Val was thinking of running for Congress, and then Dale died, and she just fell apart. Similarly, in another sort of tragic episode in Val's life that isn't talked about much, the PBS documentary, which I encourage people to watch, is quite well done, and it gets into it some. She had two sons, Michael and Dale Jr., and Dale Jr., when he was about 17, I think, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And it was hard, very hard, on everyone in the family. And Michael talks about, you know, Dale and Val, they'd have their family dinners, and at the family dinner table, that's where you solved everything. But as Michael says, you know, mental illness is not something you solve. And so Dale Jr. had his good years and his bad years, and in 2005, he died by suicide. And again, it tore Val apart. And Gwen says that Val called her after Dale Jr. committed suicide, and Gwen said she was talking in a whisper. She could barely have the energy to even say anything. But time, Val's spirit, her resilience, she was able to come back. Took a while, but she came back.
You mentioned Gwen Moore. You also spoke with Mandela Barnes for this piece as well. And, you know, you having personally spent time with her and then talking to other people who had relationships with her and also, you know, political inspirations from her, you know, she's leading this example for these other people. What insights did they share from their own personal experiences with Val?
Well, of course, one, dream big, do the right thing. Those are sort of unequivocal, and don't get in a political debate with her unless you really know what you're talking about. But the other thing, you know, and this is Val, the person that doesn't always come through. She was a little eccentric, could be cantankerous, funny sometimes, just a sharp wit. But she, two things she was really well known for. She loved to talk on the phone. All hours of the day. And if you didn't have time, don't call Val or don't take Val's phone call, because she could just, she was just, I mean, I imagine what she might have been like on social media.
Sure.
I don't know. But she loved to talk on the phone because Val was a people person. So even when she was older and she couldn't get out, she wanted to connect with people. And then the other thing, you know, at a certain age, understandably, she didn't drive anymore. Well, she was not shy about calling you up and saying, can you take me somewhere? And so that, again, would then lead to discussions in the car back and forth. And whether it's, you know, Gwen or Mandela or, you know, Maxine White, any of her close friends, they'll just laugh about, yeah, that's Val. She'll talk any time of day or night. And if she needs a ride, she's not afraid to give you a call.
I love those little insights beyond the politician, right? And we, of course, have been talking about her local impact here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but let's talk about kind of how we're finally giving her her flowers 6 years after her death. And more publicly, right? There's a statue at the state capitol and the Val R. Phillips Plaza here in Milwaukee. So how are these public and accessible spaces designed to reflect her?
It is important, I think, that she's finally getting her due. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. And one of the things I discovered in this article and over time was how well she was known at the statewide level. I mean, I know her here in Milwaukee, but a dorm was named after her in Madison. The James Madison High School is now the Val Phillips Memorial High School. She's well known around the state and in Madison. Why is she getting her due? Lots of different reasons. One, the 100th year. You know, after a century, I think people take notice. But also there's an interesting story of what happened in Madison, because it was the George Floyd protests. I mean, you know, COVID, George Floyd, that was a difficult time on many, many levels. And during one of the protests in Madison, and this had been true across the country of different statues and monuments being torn down, in the South, this was primarily Confederate segregationists. Well, in Madison, they tore down two statues. One was Lady Forward, who represents the state, you know, motto, and the other was a Norwegian-American who was an abolitionist. But interestingly, Michael Johnson, who's head of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club, he decided to go talk to the protesters. And that was a very smart move. Rather than just assuming they did what they did, why they did, he said, I'm going to talk to them. And he found that, you know, beneath the rage, beneath the anger, beneath the confusion, they had a really, really valid point that there were absolutely no statues of people of color at the Capitol. And so Michael said, you know, this is right. We should do something about it. So that began the campaign around the statue of Val Phillips at the state capitol. And here in Milwaukee, you know, Mileli Coggs, the alderperson, has a lot to do with really making sure that Val got her due. There was the renaming of 4th Street to the Val R. Phillips Drive. And then there was this pretty dingy corner there at 4th and Wisconsin, and it was city-owned. It's like, oh, what are we going to do with this? And ultimately, someone had the good sense to say, well, yeah, let's do a plaza, and let's name it after Val.
You know, we're talking about Val Phillips and you yourself having spent time, written about her in 05 and now again today in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. What sticks out the most to you about Val? Are there any insights you want to share or details or stories that didn't make it into the article?
Well, this is a personal story because it involves my mother, and Val was very close to her mother, and I had my differences with my mother, but by the end, we were quite close. And it also underscored to me that Val was a people person. So I remember once I wanted to interview her, but we couldn't find a quiet restaurant. Everything was, it was downtown. It was noisy. And I said, you know, Val, my mom lives at the Astor Hotel, and they have a quiet little coffee shop. And she goes, oh, your mom lives at the Astor? I've always wanted to see one of those apartments. Can I go see your apartment? I said, well, so I call my mom, and my mom's going like, Val Phillips, my friend. She, well, yeah, come on up. My mom was nervous because Val's pretty famous, and
yeah,
so they come
let
up.
Let me clean first, right?
Yeah. Well, my mom kept a pretty clean house, so I knew my mom was a little nervous, and I'm going, well, it's an ask, Mom, but so we go up there, and there's a little bit of hi, you know, Barbara's mother, hi, Val Phillips. Within about 2 minutes, these two older women are talking about their favorite solitaire card game. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't know, you know, if Val suddenly saw the card table with the cards, but all of a sudden they were like best buddies.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about your piece on Val Phillips. And we could talk about her for much longer, but thanks for what we talked about today.
Oh, no, thank you. And it's a homage to Val. Thank you for letting more about her get out.
Barbara Miner is a writer and photographer here in Milwaukee, and you can find her latest article about Val Phillips called Living Legacy in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
You can find more interviews like this one by visiting wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And while you're there, subscribe to the Lake Effect Spotlight podcast.